I know this fellow who wanted to make movies. He wanted to write. He wanted to direct. And most of all, he wanted to entertain people with the results. But he wanted to do it the hard way. He wanted to make family entertainment that not only entertained, but also had value, made some positive differences along the way. And consequently, he did not want to do it in Hollywood. My goal, my plan to make movies goes all the way back to the third grade, sitting in a neighborhood theater in Little Rock, Arkansas, totally captivated, mesmerized by a movie called Song of the South. Kathleen says I wrote about it better than I speak about it, so if you don't mind to sort of set the stage, I'd like to read you a short piece from Benji and Me, the book that Nancy mentioned earlier. I turned my head to the side and brushed away the tears with my shoulder, then turned back to the screen. They were all dancing off into the sunset, singing zippity-doo-dah, and I didn't want them to go. Uncle Remus and Bobby Driscoll and Luana Patton, Brer Rabbit and Brer Fox. I knew my dad would be waiting outside to pick me up, but when the final fade-out came, I didn't budge. I stayed glued to my seat. I wanted to see the beginning again, to see the names that flashed on the screen. These were the days when you could sit in a theater all afternoon for the price of one ticket. The shows were continuous because most people paid little attention to starting times. They just showed up whenever it suited them, then stayed through the next showing until they got back to the part where they came in. There was a preview, a cartoon, a newsreel that showed President Truman with the first television set to be installed in the White House. Then once again, the bright, happy music that signaled the opening of Walt Disney's Song of the South. I was mesmerized as the picture came up and all those names began to pass before me. I wanted to be one of them. I don't think it really mattered which one. That wasn't the point. It was an eagerness to be a larger part of such a delicious experience, not just a kid in the audience. It would have been nice, I suppose, to be Bobby Driscoll, since during the preceding hour and a half I had fallen hopelessly in love with his young co-star, Luana Patton. I wasn't sure what directed by meant, but it sounded important, and it was the last name on the screen, so maybe that's who I'd like to be, especially if that was the person in charge of making me feel so good. A hand touched my shoulder. Haven't you passed the point where you came in? My dad whispered. I was just coming, I said, and we walked up the aisle together. Daddy, I whispered, you know when it says directed by on the screen, what does that mean? It means he's the boss. I tugged on his hand, pausing to glance back at the screen. It was confusing because I had thought Walt Disney was the boss. The Song of the South was directed by somebody else. Come on, let's go, he whispered sternly. I blinked and imagined the words on the screen. Then the screen disappeared as the door swung shut. Daddy was dragging me from the theater. But the words had looked good, I thought, real good. Directed by Joey Camp. From that moment on, all in the world I wanted to do was to go to UCLA and study motion picture production. But when I grew up and applied, UCLA rejected me, and with it my dream of a motion picture education. I was devastated. So I stayed at Ole Miss and chose what appeared to be the next best thing, advertising, reasoning that I might be able to work my way into television commercials someday, and then who knows. After graduating from Ole Miss, I worked for an advertising agency in Houston, and 3 years later took a job with a smaller agency in Dallas, but I had never for a moment forgotten what I really wanted to do. I decided that for me, writing television scripts might be the most likely way into the business, so I began a disciplined regimen of arising at 4 a.m. every morning, 5 days a week, and writing for 2 hours before waking the family, eating breakfast, getting the kids off to school, and running off to my job at the advertising agency. I took vacation days at least twice a year to fly to Los Angeles, to beat on doors, talk to producers, writers, agents, slipping through any crevice I could find to learn more, to gain more insight, to gain more wisdom. 4 years later, I was still working at the advertising agency and still getting up at 4 every morning to write, with nothing much to show for the effort except a worn-out coffee pot and a bit of knowledge. Then one morning, one of my accounts at the agency decided they needed a sales film, a film I ultimately told them they could not possibly afford to purchase on the open market with the budget that they had, and somehow these otherwise intelligent businessmen were persuaded to let me do the film for them on weekends for cost. 13 weekends, 26 days for a 10-minute film. I knew absolutely nothing about production. So you might imagine it was loaded with production flaws, but the film worked emotionally. The homework I had done, the lessons I had learned from 4 till 6, all of those mornings, from the meetings with the writers, learning how to write, learning how to move people, all paid off. A local production house saw the film and offered me a job directing television commercials. 2 years later, we were opening the doors to our own Mulberry Square Productions, and all the while, I was still climbing out of bed at 4 every morning to write. In fact, it was during this period when the story for the original Benji was written. And I can promise you it never would have been what it was had it not been for those 5 years of early mornings and almost a dozen trips to Los Angeles. I'll never forget our first meeting with a producer-writer named Danny Arnold, who was doing a series called That Girl, starring Danny Thomas's daughter, Marlo Thomas. That's for you old folks. The two guys I was writing with and I flew out to Los Angeles and very nervously walked into Danny Arnold's office and were told to have a seat on this old overstuffed couch. I should say have a seat in this old overstuffed couch because we sank almost to the floor with our knees up in our face feeling very, very intimidated. Finally, Danny Arnold walked in and he was, of course, 6'4", so we were really looking up at him. He didn't apologize for being late. He didn't introduce himself. He just snatched the sample script off his desk that we had sent out to him earlier. And the first words out of his mouth, waving the script in our faces, was, "I love your dialogue." Ooh, smiles all around. "But your story structure sucks." Clunk. What I learned about story during that short period with Danny Arnold is almost wholly responsible for the story of the original Benji. All while I was learning about production the hard way by opening the doors to our own company, Mulberry Square Productions. In our proposal to prospective stockholders for the company, we listed two goals. First, to become the top television commercial house between the two coasts by competing with Los Angeles and New York on a basis of quality rather than competing with Dallas on a basis of price. Once achieved, our second goal was to become producers of high-quality family entertainment that was value-based. 18 months after opening the doors, we were doing more volume than any other production house in the city of Dallas on fewer jobs with better quality. Now it was time to go after that second goal. But making movies costs money. Why would anyone in their right mind invest hard-earned capital to see us do something we had never done before? Some said it was impossible. But I believe that when you set ambitious goals and you reach those goals and you can document the accomplishment against the odds, as an associate once said to me, "What you do speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you say." And I knew we couldn't fail because I had no intention of quitting. I had obviously learned to stop listening to the experts who by now were all saying it was impossible. I had the passion for it. I had been gathering knowledge and wisdom. I was ready to go. We brought in potential investors and sold 1 out of every 2. And 4 months later, we were actually making our first sit-in-a-theater-and-eat-popcorn kind of movie. My dream, at last, was coming true. More or less. A week into the shoot, I had to fire the gaffer. A week after that, Don Reddy, our director of photography, quit. And it was up to me to somehow get him back. Record rainfall for North Texas, 9.38 inches, 4 times the July norm, buffeted and sank our schedule. When it wasn't raining, it was so hot we had to trade in Benji's 1-ton air conditioner for a 3-ton unit to keep his tongue from dragging the ground. It was a standard home compressor, huge, heavy, not portable at all. Yet it had to follow Benji everywhere he went, gobbling up unscheduled time and money. The actress we flew in to play the neighborhood lady with the cat persuaded me, intimidated me, into letting her play the scene a bit tipsy. It wasn't right. I knew it at the time, and the dailies confirmed it. Every night for a week, I would go upstairs to the editing room and ask the editor to put the film up again, hoping, praying each time that the scenes would look better. They never did. We finally threw the film away, flew in another actress, and shot the scenes again, which meant that I had to tell our trainer, Frank N., that he had to fly the cats back in and start over with their training. Now, you have to understand that cats aren't like dogs. You know, where you have one dog, one Benji doing the thing. When you have a cat that has to run to a tree and jump up on a tree and go over to the lady, as one cat goes to the tree, the next cat's trained to go up the tree, the next cat's trained to go out on the limb, the next cat's trained to sit on the lady's shoulder. And so he had about five or six cats there. Happiest day in his life was when he sent those cats home. And I had to go tell him he had to bring the cats back again. The Dallas Parks Department decided to spray the grasses of Samuel's Park with a highly toxic insecticide dangerous to dogs on the very day they had given us permission to shoot our slow motion love montage. The actor playing the kid's father was commuting by car from Dallas all the way to Austin every night to star in a dinner theater production of The Rainmaker. He had promised, of course, that the play would have no effect on our schedule or his ability to perform in Benji. And of course, he was late to the set most mornings, missed several calls completely, was generally incoherent when he showed up, and he fell asleep one night at the wheel on his way back to Dallas and hit a tree and wound up in the hospital. It's okay, but there went a day. We discovered that Benji's little Maltese friend, Tiffany, was typecast, a dumb blonde, couldn't act a lick. Our second try at the scenes in Samuel Park found huge sprinklers exactly where we wanted to shoot. 9.38 inches of rain wasn't enough for the Dallas Parks Department. And the sprinklers could not be shut down for a day, nor could they be moved. We had to wait. The hundreds of butterflies we collected for the end of the love montage all died. Twice. My seven-week schedule stretched to 11, and my partner, Ed Vanston, had to sell off a chunk of Mulberry's share of the profits to raise more money to cover the extra time. We spent the better part of 3 months on our knees and bellies stacked on top of each other, scrunched into impossible spaces, attempting to look up at our floppy-eared hero. Placing the camera, you know, just slightly below an actor's eye level tends to make him appear stronger, more in control, more heroic. People always think actors like Tom Cruise are taller than they really are. So it's not a new phenomenon with short actors. But short is a relative term. Placing the camera below a human actor's eye level, I assume, creates no unusual problems. But Benji stands a mere 13 inches off the floor, and much of the time he was lying down. New camera rigs and devices had to be designed virtually on a daily basis. The crew came up with an entire arsenal of creative new gear, from simple plastic Lazy Susans bought at the dime store to complex welded rigs that hung off the sides of camera dollies, dangled from pickup trucks, dropped off the bases of tripod heads, and circled like merry-go-rounds. I believe we even had the first skateboard in the world, but it transported a camera, not a teenager. The lens was simply never allowed to look down on Benji unless there was a special and specific reason for it to do so. And through all the mistakes, mishaps, detours, delays, the most important element of the picture was working. The point of view and the emotional heart of the story were leaping off the screen with more fidelity than even I had hoped for. Screening raw dailies with scenes out of context, out of sequence, with slates and crew noise and trainers' voices on the tracks. When Benji's face filled the screen and those big brown eyes went to work, truly magical things were happening. Benji was acting. 2 decades of dreaming, 9 years of work and study, and the dream had finally come true. Except for one little thing. After writing for 2 months, shooting for 3, and editing for 3 more, we discovered that the picture was 10 minutes too short to be a real theatrical feature. I was devastated. The money was gone. We had a movie we couldn't sell. If we went back to investors, I'd have to admit that I'd miscalculated, and I'd rather have taken a beating than return to the typewriter to attempt to create something to stuff inside the middle of a movie I thought was finished. But of course, the alternative was worse. So we showed some folks what we had, sold off still more of our profits, and back to the typewriter I went. We brought the cast back into town and shot for another week, trying to make December look like July, trying to hide the fact that our little girl star, Cindy, had lost 2 of her front teeth. And believe it or not, the addition turned out to be one of the best sequences in the movie. At long, long last, we had a good movie. It entertained, it made people feel just like we had hoped, and it was long enough So the rest should be history, right? Not even close. We showed the film to every major distributor in Hollywood, and every one of them turned it down. When it was all over, we had two choices: throw it in the trash or figure it out. Throw it in the trash or try to raise still more money, sell off more of Mulberry's share of the picture, do a lot more learning, and distribute it ourselves. This time, everybody told us it was impossible. Distributing films is a complex business built on years of experience and contacts. It was no place for a novice with an unknown G-rated film. The big boys control the theaters. The expensive pictures dominate. Forget it, Joe, I was told time and time again. After all, what did I really know about distribution? Exactly the same thing I knew about production before we rolled the first camera. So it was back to the baby's way of problem solving, because it works. One foot in front of the other. One step, one problem at a time. And that's how the distribution of Benji began. One step at a time in Dallas with one theater. It took some doing, but fortunately, at the time, this was easily the best theater in Dallas. And we opened with a strong B-. Good, but not good enough to put lines around the block and turn Benji into the major hit we believed it could be. So we spent the entire summer changing the advertising and marketing, and with each change, opening a new market, then analyzing the difference in grosses, then doing it all over again and again, until finally, on August 1st, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we hit the first home run, A double plus, right through the roof. 2 weeks later in Baltimore, we proved to ourselves that it was no fluke. The picture set two house records. We could have accepted B- and opened the film nationwide back in June, but we didn't. No was an answer. I learned that one from God. And at last, we had a marketing plan that would turn Benji into a major hit. There was still one more problem. The summer was over. Kids were headed back to school, and parents were back in front of the television and off at football games. Our only choice was to go back to investors and tell them we had decided to put off national distribution for a year until the following summer. You could hear the screaming from here. But that's exactly what we did, except we did open Los Angeles at Thanksgiving so we could qualify the title song for an Academy Award nomination, which we got, along with a Golden Globe Award, which of course helped the promotion that much more. The picture finally opened across the country, rolling out beginning in June of the following year, and through the entire summer, grossed a total of $31 million at the box office. In today's equivalent, that's about $140 million. And now, 30 years after his first movie was released, by actual survey, more than 95% of the households in this country know Benji, and most of them feel affection for the character. Worldwide, over 72 million, more than half of them adults, have watched Benji movies in theaters, and over a billion have watched him on television. The videos of his first two movies and four television specials were reintroduced to the video sales market 10 years ago, and in 3 short years sold 2.5 million units. This 20 years after that first movie was released. And this past August, those same movies were reintroduced once again and are selling at twice the rate of the distributor's projections, now 30 years after the original release. But I haven't wandered through all this so you'd say, isn't he smart? Isn't he clever? But to demonstrate, to prove beyond any doubt the kind of thing that can be accomplished if you want it bad enough, if you dare to dream, if you quit listening to the naysayers, if you are passionate enough to work hard enough to learn and gain wisdom enough to be persistent enough to eliminate failure from your vocabulary, to always remember that you cannot fail unless you quit. But a lot of people don't understand that they are in control of their destiny. As Andy Andrews says, the buck stops here. A lot of people don't realize that, and we've got to get the word out. We've got to tell folks, especially young people. And we've got to tell them that it's not the easy way that gets things done. Keep your own experimental record on this if you like and track it. I have. 99 times out of 100, the easy way is not the best way. When you start taking the easy way, more often than not, you are going to start bogging down. Kathleen and I were in New York a few months back driving up this mountain road, and we came up behind this huge flatbed truck loaded with hundreds of these big crates with little bitty holes in them. The truck was just barely making up the hill. It was one of those narrow, winding roads, and I couldn't get by, so I settled in behind. And before long, the truck stopped, and the driver got out with this big 2x4, walked around to the back of the truck, and commenced to beat the truck. Well, I was amazed. But another couple of miles up the mountain, the truck stopped again, and here came the driver with his 2x again, and he was beating on the truck. Well, I stood it about as long as I could, and the next time the truck stopped, I got out and approached the driver and said, "Pardon me, sir. I couldn't help noticing how you've been stopping every few miles and beating up on your truck there, and I must admit my curiosity's got the best of me. How come you're doing it?" And the driver said, "Mister, I got me a 2-ton truck here, and I'm hauling 4 tons of canaries. Unless I keep half of them flying, I'm overloaded." That man definitely did not take the easy way out of his predicament, but did you notice? He got the job done. You see, it's up to us to keep our lives from bogging down. When life deals us 4 tons of canaries and we've only got a 2-ton truck, it's up to us to keep things airborne, not other folks.